Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Linda. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Wednesday, February 4th, 2026. Section A. Devon and Coterra deal creates dynamo. Company created by $26 billion merger will be major shale player in the Permian Basin. By Mella McEwen, oil editor. A major new shale player is entering the Permian Basin with the $26 billion merger of Devon Energy and Coterra Energy. Combined, the entity, to be known as Devon Energy, will have a $58 billion enterprise value and a major footprint in the Delaware Basin with more than 10 years of high-quality inventory. Coterra's Delaware Basin holdings were its crown jewel, and the same with Devon, said Clay Gasper, Devon President and Chief Executive Officer. He will serve in that role when the merger is completed. Speaking with the Reporter Telegram, Gasper praised the depth and quality of assets that will belong to the combined company and said it will prompt a rebalancing once the merger is complete in the second quarter. Coterra brings more natural gas to the mix, he explained. This will unlock opportunities with such a large natural gas portfolio. He cited such opportunities as joint ventures in natural gas processing facilities. Two of Coterra's three core positions, the Delaware and Anadarko basins, overlap with Devon's, he noted. Coterra is also active in the Marcellus Shale. When you peel back the onion, what I'm excited about is the technical savviness on both teams, the technical value, the value orientation. That's where there's success in integration, Gasper said. After a menu of smaller corporate transactions and asset deals in 2025, consolidation among large cap E&Ps is back on the table. Andrew Dittmar, principal analyst at Enverus Intelligence Research, told the Reporter Telegram, "The deal is comparable in size to Diamondback's Endeavor purchase and the fourth largest upstream combination since 2020. The acquisition is another example of multi-basin merger and acquisition activity, which has included combinations by smaller public E&Ps," Dittmar said. That type of deal is more common as the U.S. upstream space progresses further into a multi-year consolidation cycle and opportunities to strategically add exposure to one core play have become scarce. Investors have often cast a skeptical eye towards these types of deals and panned combinations that appeared to simply be the pursuit of scale. The tie-up of Devon and Coterra has strategic rationale supporting it. The companies share exposure to the Anadarko and Delaware basins. The merger plan calls for $1 billion in annual synergies by year-end 2027, including $700 million in capital optimization and margin improvements. Synergies are a cornerstone of the all-equity combination, and longer-term success of the deal will, in a large part, hinge on delivering synergy capture. He called the Delaware Basin the real prize of the deal from Devon's perspective and the centerpiece of the combined company. The deal propels Devon from third largest to top producer in the prolific Delaware Basin based on gross operated volumes and positions it as a top three overall Permian producer on a gross operated basis with more than 1 million barrels of oil equivalent per day. It is also a hotbed for resource expansion, with Coterra one of the companies leading the way on unlocking new zones. Devon will now add this to its existing footprint in the play, and the Delaware will play a key role in delivering on expected synergies, Dittmar said. He concluded, "The combination of Devon and Coterra demonstrates that the wave of consolidation sweeping U.S. shale isn't finished yet, and the march towards fewer, larger producers feels inevitable. That said, it doesn't necessarily presage a stampede of mergers like what was seen in 2023 and 24, when companies may have felt pressure to jump in or be left behind. With fewer obvious targets left, corporate deal-making from here is likely a slow, methodical grind of finding the right partner at the right point in time. The combined company will be headquartered in Houston, while maintaining a significant presence in Oklahoma City. Tom Jordan, currently Chairman, Chief Executive Officer, and President of Coterra, will assume the role of non-executive chairman of the board. Midland Development Corporation swears in new board. Four members welcomed. Gains seen in sales tax and social media by Mella McEwen. Four new members were sworn on to Midland Development Corporation's Board of Directors Monday, February 2nd, at the MDC's monthly meeting. Joining the board are Abraham Behiel, Darpan Bhakta, Hayden Boldrick, and Denzel West. "We'd like to welcome you all on board," MDC Board Chairman Brad Bullock told the quartet after they recited their oaths. Judd Campbell then spoke during public comment period, urging the board to remember there are legal limits on how the MDC can spend its funds. "It's important for the citizens who expect you to follow those limits," he said. Campbell also called for the board to prioritize manufacturing and industrial projects, calling them the foundation of economic development. "Investing in retail is exciting. It's interesting, but it's not an economic driver," he said. In conclusion, he told board members, "Respect that. Respect the taxpayers." Serving alongside Bullock as MDC officers are L.V. Brown as First Vice President, First Vice Chair, and Garrett Donnelly as Secretary. Bullock said elections will be held at the March board meeting to fill the remaining two positions, second vice chair and treasurer. MDC Executive Director Sarah Harris reported a 16% increase in sales tax receipts and pointed out to board members $33,568 in prior year committed incentives. MDC Marketing Coordinator Paige McCartney told board members of increases in the MDC's social media, with Facebook engagements up 27%, Instagram 23%, LinkedIn 19%, and TikTok up 11%. The top posts, which focused on economic development, had between 68,000 and 91,000 impressions, she said. Bomb detection canine welcomed to county. Dutch-trained dog trained in tracking and detecting explosives by B.K. Richter. Midland County is welcoming its newest crime-fighting partner, R2, a one-and-a-half-year-old bomb detection canine who has recently arrived in Midland. R2 is a Belgian Malinois German Shepherd mix, originally from Holland, and only responds to verbal commands in Dutch. Additionally, the canine partner is highly trained in not only tracking, but also detecting explosive materials such as C4, TNT, and other explosive compounds. R2 will accompany agents and investigators on a wide range of calls, including SWAT operations, whenever there is a potential threat involving explosives or suspicious devices, county officials said. Arson investigator Michael Poole is R2's handler. R2 gives us an added layer of safety and confidence when responding to potentially dangerous situations, Poole said. His training and abilities allow us to detect threats quickly and protect both first responders and the public. The cost and training for R2, as well as a soon-to-arrive arson detection dog, were fully funded through a grant from Chevron, eliminating any cost to taxpayers, said the county. Midland County officials stated that R2 will serve a 17-county region across West Texas and the Permian Basin. Over the coming weeks, the canine partner will also continue advanced training alongside his handler to further strengthen their working partnership. This is a major asset, not just for Midland County, but for the entire region, said Fire Marshal Justin Bunch. R2's presence strengthens our response capabilities and ensures we remain prepared for potential threats. Once fully trained and cleared for service, R2 will officially replace Mia, Midland County's bomb detection dog for the past 9 years. Mia will retire from service after nearly a decade of public work. Venue at Live Oak Noise Complaint Review Completed by Luke Diaz. The city's six-month review process of the venue at Live Oak has ended, and City Council will let the event center continue selling alcohol. In the first half of 2025, residents in nearby neighborhoods filed complaints regarding the loud volume of the music. When Midland City Council was made aware of this, it set a six-month period to collect and evaluate any further noise complaints. This was completed by an August 12, 2025 approval for a specific use designation to sell alcohol. We don't have a consistent decibel level, which makes it difficult for them to catch the culprit or catch the issue when it's taking place, said City Manager Tommy Gonzalez. But they visit with the person who made the complaint if they're nearby, and they also visit with the business or residents being complained on and talk through the issues with them to try to get them to voluntarily comply. During this time, the venue at Live Oak was instructed to not have its sound any higher than 85 decibels in order to receive its temporary land use permit, which it complied with as verified through decibel records. City staff found that while there were 5 noise complaints between January and July 2025, there were only 2 during the six-month period of review, both coming from Todd Drive to the west of the property. The first complaint was during the Boot campaign, a fundraiser for disabled veterans, recalled Steve Jeter, the owner of the venue at Live Oak. The event was over at 10:30 p.m. We recorded the decibel levels of the event, and they averaged between 65 and 70. The second complaint was during the Christmas party for a local company. The music was inside the tent, walls down, doors shut. The decibel reading was 85 decibels outside the tent. I also have statements signed by 9 neighbors who are the same distance away or closer to the complaining neighbors, and they said that they have no issues with noise or traffic, especially since Elkins Road, where the venue at Live Oak is located, does not intersect with Todd Drive in any manner. Another criteria for the temporary land use permit was for the venue at Live Oak to have peace officers at the site, though it was deemed to be redundant because the location already has personal security. According to Jeter, Tom Hain, affiliated with the Midland County Sheriff's Office, has been in charge of their security for the past 3 years. We have security present anytime there's alcohol served, and Tom has discretion of the amount of security and traffic control needed for any safety concerns, Jeter said. Tom has also provided a letter to planning and zoning in which he states there have been no disturbances or traffic concerns during any of the events during his tenure. From these results, City Council was given three options. Amend the permits to remove the restrictions, which would start the process all over again. Revoke the permits, which would also force the venue at Live Oak to begin the process all over again with the PNC Commission. Or take no action and let the permits continue with the noise requirement until they naturally expire on August 12th, 2027. While evaluating the data, some city council members, citing a need to avoid doing such situations repeatedly, suggested having a blanket decibel limit for the city. We're kind of putting the onus of compliance on the owner that we need to make sure is consistent throughout the city, said council member Brian Stubbs, who said he has engaged in email correspondence with Jeter sometime during the six-month period. I think this is actually an opportunity to go look at those noise ordinances in both commercial and residential zoning to make sure we can enforce those throughout the city. I think this is a great idea, and I think it kind of solved the problem with the neighbors. I think this is a good model for us to move forward, but I do think it needs to be in the ordinance and not in a specific case. The number of incidents are growing as the city grows, and we become more dense inside the city limits. So having an ordinance citywide, I think, would be very beneficial. Gonzalez disagreed, arguing that a blanket decibel limit would ignore the nuances of how decibel limits affect different areas. He did, however, express interest in modifying the ordinance to make it easier for people looking to have noise on their premises. I think it works best when there's voluntary compliance and when neighbors work well with neighbors, Gonzalez said. We can certainly look at how this worked, see what kind of adjustments we can make to the ordinance, because if people know up front what they're walking into, that's helpful. I think that part of it could be more robust, and that could be helpful to the people who are asking for permits. Gonzalez and City Council ultimately agreed to discuss this further at a strategic planning session, with city staff collecting their findings on how to deliver a nuanced noise system that can work for all. In the meantime, City Council voted to grant the venue at Live Oak its specific use designation and temporary land use permit without any further decibel restrictions in order to not put a cap on them before such findings can be collected. However, Jeter confirmed that he still plans on having decibel limits on what bands play out of consideration for the neighbors. We want to be good neighbors, and we want to monitor that, Jeter concluded. Our deal was, we just didn't feel like it was fair to impose that on us alone. I think voluntary compliance is a good idea, and there's a lot you can do. I'm working with the city just because I know it's an issue, and I don't want it to be something that I'm fighting over with other neighbors long term. BCM Doc Prep Program Open to Rising Seniors by Kesley Salinas. Midland ISD is expanding its partnership with Baylor College of Medicine, BCM, to offer a summer opportunity for rising seniors interested in careers in medicine and health sciences. Eligible high school juniors are invited to apply for the BCM Doc Prep Program, a week-long medical career exploration held at the Baylor College of Medicine campus in Houston. The Doc Prep Program is part of MISD's STEM Plus M initiative, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and medicine, which connects rigorous academics with authentic real-world experiences aligned to medical and healthcare career pathways. The program is highly competitive and will be offered at no cost to 8 MISD students. These students will be selected district-wide to participate in the summer program. Here are the eligibility requirements. Students must currently be in 11th grade and have completed their junior year by the time of the experience. Students must demonstrate a strong interest in medicine or health sciences. Students must rank in the top 25% of their class. Students must be enrolled and in good standing at LHS or MHS. The program's application deadline is February 27th. Students can apply using the Baylor College of Medicine Doc Prep Program application. Students are encouraged to review the full program requirements and details through the materials linked in the application. The STEM plus M program is made possible through the support of the Scarber Foundation. Hints from Heloise. Dear Heloise, I'm getting married in the beginning of this year. My cooking skills aren't just bad, they're horrible. I burn far too many dishes and ruin pots and pans. The majority of my dishes are totally bland. My husband-to-be has suffered through a number of disgusting dinners because I don't know what I'm doing. We both work, and sometimes I have to work overtime, which means that dinner is often thrown together. I'm writing to ask about certain terms that are used in cooking, because maybe if I understood these terms, I might be able to improve and stop making watery rice with burnt chicken. Can you tell me what these terms mean? Score, roux, ragu, frizzle, and mirepoix. Cindy in Bloomfield, Michigan. Cindy, here are the meanings of these terms. Score, to cut gashes into the meat surface. This is often done on a meat that is tough, such as flank steak. Roux, a mixture of butter and flour cooked to a smooth paste until it is either just thickened or thickened and lightly brown. Ragu, a rich brown stew. Frizzle, to fry in hot fat until the edges of the food curl. Mirepoix, a French term for a combination of finely chopped and sautéed vegetables, which are then usually added to a casserole or a dish where you will be braising the meat. Heloise. Getting organized. Dear Heloise, I have two cabinets in the cellar, and I have a small house with no space in the kitchen. One cabinet is for items that are used weekly, such as pasta, rice, peanut butter, soup, dry items, tomato sauce or paste, bathroom supplies, etc. However, on one Saturday, my daughter went to retrieve something in the cabinet and told me, "Mom, this expired 2 years ago." I reorganized each of the four shelves so that the top shelf is for items that expire in the current year, then the next, and so forth. Each shelf is labeled by year. The other one is full of items for what if. Non-perishables, pasta and other dry items, dry milk, water, toilet paper, towels, warm blankets, etc. Now I'm organized. MP via email. Abandoned puppies. Dear Heloise, last week my husband and I were taking a walk through a wooded area near our home. We came across a cardboard box with two puppies of about 5 or 6 weeks old. There was no food or water and only a towel on the bottom of the box. Clearly they had been abandoned. They shivered with the cold and clung to each other because they were frightened. Our vet said if they spent one or two more freezing nights in the cold, the puppies would have died. Why do people do things like this? The mother should have been spayed, and no one has the right to treat any animal like trash to be tossed away. They feel the cold and rejection. They also feel hunger and need someone to take them in and care for them. If you have a dog, cat, or any animal, it's your responsibility to take good care of them. We decided to keep these little guys, and what a joy they are to have. Matthew and Diane in New Hampshire. Midland man, 26, dies in two-vehicle collision. By B.K. Richter. Winkler County. A Midland man is dead following a two-vehicle collision. According to the Department of Public Safety, the incident occurred at approximately 6:25 a.m. Saturday, January 31st, along State Highway 302 at mile marker 214. Angel Galindo, 26, of Midland, was transported to Winkler Memorial Hospital and pronounced dead by medical staff. Preliminary information from the DPS report indicated that a 2024 GMC Sierra was westbound on State Highway 302. The second vehicle, a 2025 Ford F-250, was traveling eastbound on State Highway 302. For reasons unknown at this time, the driver of the GMC, identified as Galindo, veered into the eastbound lane and collided with the Ford. This crash remains under investigation, and no additional information has been released to the public at this time. Life tributes for Wednesday, February 4th. Enoch Edward Diffie. Enoch Edward Diffie passed away January 26th. He was born to Paul and Laverne Diffie November 11th, 1954, in Hale Center. He is survived by his wife, Suzanne, son, Paul, and his wife, Alexa, and two grandchildren, all of Wilmington, North Carolina. He is also survived by his sister, Cois Honeycutt, of Roswell, New Mexico. Enoch was preceded in death by his parents, Paul and Laverne Diffie. Arrangements have been entrusted to the care of Cobble Funeral Home and Crematory. A thank you to the teams of Spring Arbor Senior Living and Amadeus Hospice Care. There will be no services. Alan Lee Crane, Jr. Alan Lee Crane, Jr. of Midland passed away Thursday, January 22nd, at the age of 77. He was born August 14th, 1948, in Ponca City, Oklahoma, to Alan Lee Crane, Sr. and Catherine Cassidy Crane. He was preceded in death by his parents and a brother, Robert Crane. Alan is survived by his sister, Carol DeVault of El Dorado, Arkansas, his brother, James Crane of Midland, a niece and her sons, and a nephew and wife. A graveside service will be held at 3 p.m. Friday, February 6th at Rest Haven Memorial Park with Reverend Robbie Boyd officiating. Arrangements are under the direction of Nally Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Delberta McCutcheon Dixon. Delberta M. Dixon, 90, passed away January 23rd. She was the firstborn to Henry and Juanita McCutcheon, March 4th, 1935, in Robertson County, and raised around Marlin. Surviving her are her children, Rosie Lee Hall, Virginia Ann Curtis, Leanna Marie Sanders, and Junior Lee Dixon, Jr. Six grandchildren, three great-grandchildren, and her sisters, cousins, nieces, and nephews. A funeral service was held Tuesday, February 3rd at Antioch Baptist Church in Midland, with Pastor Ronald Van Dyke officiating. Interment immediately followed at Fairview Cemetery. Funeral arrangements are in the care of Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Online condolences can be made at asanchezTFH.com. Rosalia Quintela. Rosalia Quintela, 91, of Midland, passed away January 29th. Rosary was recited Tuesday, February 3rd at Nellie Picklin Welch Chapel. Funeral Mass was held Wednesday, February 4th at Our Lady of Guadalupe Catholic Church. Interment will follow at Serenity Memorial Gardens Cemetery. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Picklin Welch Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Dear Abby, couples still maintain two homes after years together. Dear Abby, I am a widow who has been dating a widower for the past 8 years. He's a wonderful man and the love of my life. We both have children, so we have been extremely careful not to cause them any distress with our relationship, and we have kept our home lives pretty separate. At first, I thought that when the kids graduated from high school, we would maybe change our living situation. But now, with all of our kids in college, the kids are going back and forth. One has moved home with me, so a change still doesn't seem appropriate. However, even when the kids are all out of college and living on their own, I'm still not sure I want to move into his house. It's an amazing home in a wonderful town with lots of room for me, but it was built with his deceased wife, and all of her things and decorations permeate the place. I just don't feel I could ever make it my home, as it was their family home from the time they were married and where they raised their daughter. Moving into my house is not an option because it is small, and I don't think he would want to do that. I thought we could possibly sell both places and buy something together, but again, his house is such an amazing place that I doubt we could find anything comparable. What should I do? Making a change or not? Dear Making, I think it is time you and your longtime partner have a serious, honest conversation about what your options are after all the children are finally independent. Express that as beautiful as his home is, you have qualms because it was the home in which he and his late wife raised a family. Tell him you fear any changes would be resented, and the house you live in is just too small. Then listen to what he has to say. Dear Abby, I recently became aware that someone I know through various community groups is married to a man who is on the local sex offenders list involving a child under 13. This information was confirmed by another community group member as we needed to see how it would affect his volunteer status and our location near a school. I don't know how to respond to this information. The man is pleasant and friendly. If I had not known this information, I would have suggested he and his wife get together with my husband and other friends. There are no children in my household, so no one would be endangered by his presence. Should this information about his sex offender status change how I see or respect him? Neither he nor his wife know that I know, and I don't plan to tell them or anyone else. What are my responsibilities if I see him around children? On Alert in Michigan. Dear On Alert, whether or not to see or respect this person is a decision only you can make. No one can do that for you. However, if you see a sex offender in the presence of minor children, you are morally and ethically bound to report it.
And up next, Midland YMCA launches new capital campaign with $1 million gift from the Scarber Foundation. A transformational vision is taking shape at the Midland YMCA, and it's all beginning with a generous $1 million lead gift from the Scarborough Foundation to launch the A Better Place to Connect Downtown Aquatic and Social Expansion Capital Campaign. The exciting new project will provide a long-awaited indoor aquatic facility featuring a zero-entry pool, lap lanes, whirlpool, recreational slide, and upgraded wet areas. The expansion will also include a vibrant new space for social connection, reinforcing the Y's role as a community cornerstone, a news release said. The Scarborough Foundation has long been a catalyst for meaningful change in Midland and the Permian Basin, championing initiatives that promote opportunity, strengthen families, and uplift the region. Their $1 million commitment not only propels the campaign forward, but also affirms their belief in the YMCA's mission to serve the community through youth development, healthy living, and social responsibility. Christine Bearden, CEO of the Midland YMCA, said in the release, "With this cornerstone gift, the Midland YMCA is poised to begin the next chapter in its legacy of service." Stay tuned for more updates and ways to get involved. For updates on the campaign and to learn how you can support, visit MidlandYMCA.org or follow the Midland YMCA on Facebook.
Local game designer builds dragon simulator game. It's when the dragon jumped and made a spin that Alvy Spurlock's then one-year-old son started to laugh. The jump and spin animation is more than just a fun feature in Spurlock's passion project computer game, Scorchlet. It's a bug he purposely left in because it made his son happy. It's one of many unique things he left in the game during its creation. "I think games these days are too polished," Spurlock said. "I think back in the early 2000s when those games were not polished at all, but they're some of the best games to this day." Designing the game over an 8-month period, Scorchlet, that's spelled S-C-O-R-C-H-L-E-T, is a pet simulation game where players raise a dragon. The game, available for free online, though donations are asked to help Spurlock continue working on updates, allows players to play, feed, hunt, and mine with their dragon. The game is the latest creation for Mad Tea Party Development, which Spurlock created with Alexander Spicer. The idea of the game came to Spurlock after attending a screening of the live-action version of How to Train Your Dragon. Watching the crowd become excited and sharing in the moments gave him a sense of belonging and community. Wanting to preserve the moment, he started working on the game with a sense of togetherness in mind. To make the community as large as possible, Spurlock has made sure to make the game as inclusive as possible. It contains options for a colorblind-friendly user interface, simple controls, and balanced stimulation where no more than 3 sounds are playing at once. "I went out of my way to make sure this game can be played by anyone," Spurlock said. The game can be downloaded on the website itch.io and, while still in beta, a testing period to find bugs and fine-tune the game, donations can be made to help Spurlock as he plans to offer additional updates to Scorchlet. "I want the game to be as good as it can be," he said.
And up next, MISD students invited to apply for prestigious Baylor College of Medicine Doc Prep Program. Midland ISD expanded their partnership with Baylor College of Medicine, BCM, to offer a unique summer opportunity for rising seniors interested in careers in medicine and health sciences. Eligible high school juniors are invited to apply for the BCM Doc Prep Program, a highly competitive, no-cost, week-long medical career exploration experience held on the Baylor College of Medicine campus in Houston. Only 8 Midland ISD students will be selected district-wide to participate in the summer program. To be eligible, students must be currently in 11th grade and have completed their junior year by the time of the experience, demonstrate a strong interest in medicine or health sciences, rank in the top 25% of their class, be enrolled in good standing at LHS or MHS. The application deadline is February 27th. Students should apply using the Baylor College of Medicine Doc Prep Program application and review full program requirements and details through the materials linked in the application. The BCM Doc Prep Program is part of Midland ISD's STEM plus M initiative, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, and medicine, which connects rigorous academics with authentic real-world experience aligned to medical and healthcare career pathways. The program is made possible through the support of the Scarber Foundation.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Monday, February 2nd. Forum allowed candidates to introduce themselves. The candidates vying for the role of the highest-ranking elected official in Ector County pitched themselves as pragmatic leaders who'd account for voter input as they made decisions during a public forum Thursday night. Attendees at the event, a job interview-style forum hosted by the Ector County Republican Party, heard featured candidates running for Ector County Judge, political newcomer Sunil Mehta, a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and Dustin Fawcett, the one-term incumbent. The two will face off on the March 3rd primary ballot on the GOP ticket. There is no Democratic challenger, so the winner will be County Judge. At the heart of the debate was proactive governance, voter outreach, and responsible spending. Both candidates argued they had the experience and the track record to take on the oilfield town that is grappling with aging infrastructure and facilities, a tight budget, and low voter turnout. The questions during the town hall were timely, dealing with issues the county has taken on, such as roads and infrastructure, preventative maintenance, voter engagement, construction projects, and spending. Recently, Ector County took on nearly $300 million in debt to renovate the dilapidated, decades-old courthouse. Fawcett also ushered a campaign to establish an emergency services district for West Odessa, most of which does not have access to basic services, including ambulances. Billions of dollars in road projects are at play. Mehta said his experience in the U.S. Marine Corps gave him the experience to tackle issues proactively, from ensuring county facilities were up to date and consistently maintained, to reaching out to the county's residents before he made any decision. Quote, "You want to talk with both sides," Mehta said. "You want to try as best you can to come up with a reasonable solution that fits both sides. A bad decision made quickly is better than a good decision made too late. Decisions can always be fixed, they can be readjusted, but if you're too late on making a decision, that's it. Time has passed," end quote. Mehta said he'd be a proactive fixer, citing his experience in the Marine Corps. He also said he trusted the county's employees, whom he called among the most talented, to help him make decisions about projects and spending. Fawcett, for his part, presented his track record as county judge, of which he is serving his first term. He said he ran as a solutions-oriented Republican and helped save the county money by ending county inmate housing, which he said saved taxpayers $1 million. He also added his efforts to crack down on so-called game rooms. For the most part, Fawcett said his successes as county judge were in part thanks to planning. He said planning across several areas, hazard mitigation, road and water infrastructure, can and has saved the county money. Quote, "We've always been reactive rather than proactive," Fawcett said, of the county's overall infrastructure. "We have to catch up with the past, which is why you're seeing a lot of actions being taken by this commissioner's court. We felt the need to initiate game plans in order to address those, and so plans are vital in case we see an additional bucket of funds, end quote. Asked about election integrity, Mehta said he trusted the county system and ability to run elections. Fawcett, for his part, said voter identification was necessary to ensure voter integrity and to make the process as smooth as possible, so more people will vote. On whether a building should be rebuilt or renovated, Mehta said it comes down to preventative maintenance because it costs less. Fawcett said he factored many things into his decision, including environmental issues. He also said the county spent less money by hiring in-house contractors. As for debt, Mehta said the county should focus on its existing debt before taking on more. Quote, "You can't move forward and keep kicking the can down the road. You're just creating a bigger mess," he said, adding, "It should be left to voters to decide. You need to work to get that under control, and then you move on." Fawcett said taking on debt now will alleviate any problems for future county judges and commissioners. He also said the county would do well by attracting other industries, such as data centers and corporate operations. Quote, "We don't have to look at going out for more debt anytime soon," he said. "We took that burden off any future commissioner's work for decades. We addressed the elephant in the room and were proud of it," Fawcett said, of the coming courthouse. Candidates running for County Commissioner Precinct 4 and 2 also spoke and introduced themselves and answered a few questions. Incumbent Precinct 4 Commissioner Billy Hall and his opponent Marty Slayton. In Precinct 2, a crowded field introduced themselves, including Don Stringer, Grayson Hankins, Richard Pierce, Jason Payne, and James Poor. City leaders break ground on new sports complex. The story was written by Michael Bauer. Odessa city leaders gathered for the groundbreaking ceremony of the new sports complex facility Thursday at the end of North Vaudrey Road. The facility, which will include the 7-acre Amy Bell Park, will feature a 140,000-square-foot indoor facility that will include 10 basketball courts, 20 volleyball courts, and pickleball parks, along with dedicated fitness and training areas. Outdoor amenities will include 10 rectangle fields for soccer and football, 12 diamond fields for baseball and softball, and a community amphitheater for events and performances. Back in May 2023, Larry Bell and his family donated 100 acres at the end of North Vaudrey Road past Yukon Road for a sports complex. The total cost will be $140 million. Odessa Mayor Cal Hendrick and members of the Odessa City Council were in attendance as the construction of the project was officially launched. The project is scheduled to be completed by early 2028. The ceremony included speeches from Hendrick and City Council member Steve Thompson. Quote, "Sports give everyone a chance to excel and look for excellence, and this facility is the beginning of so many opportunities for our community to come together," Hendrick said. Hendrick used a quote from legendary Green Bay Packers coach Vince Lombardi while speaking to the audience. Quote, "As we embark on this, we're reminded of the words from the legend Vince Lombardi. Sports teaches you character and to play by the rules. It teaches you what it feels like to win and lose. It teaches you about life." "I think this is something to think about," Hendrick said. At the conclusion of the ceremony, community leaders gathered for the ceremonial dirt tossing. Hendrick spoke with the media after the ceremony. Quote, "I'm so excited today," Hendrick said. "It's been a long time coming. host volleyball tournaments, basketball tournaments, baseball tournaments, 7-on-7 tournaments, and soccer and softball tournaments. There are so many options. It's going to be a huge economic boom for Odessa with all of those tournaments. It's going to be a big economic boom for our community, and it's good for our children. It's to help our kids build up their skills and teach them life and sportsmanship, as well as everything about competition. Sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. It helps them develop the right attitude and take the losses with the wins. It's a great thing for Odessa and our children, and it's going to be a fantastic facility. End quote. Other speakers included City Councilman Steve Thompson, Director of Construction Management with Sports Med Properties Mike Stewart, as well as Midland Basin Business Unit Asset Director with Oxy, Corey Payne, President and Chief Operating Officer of the Kent Companies, Todd Watkins, and Founding Partner of the Sports Facilities Companies, Eric Sullivan. The project had been in the planning stages for close to 3 years. Quote, "It takes so much processing to get everything to go right," Hendrick said. Quote, "We have to fund it, for one, and design the facility. It's been a lot of challenges. You have to get the right team together, but it's going to be a fantastic facility for everyone," end quote. Energy industry weathers Fern as workers adapt to conditions. Steady supply of natural gas plays crucial role. The story was written by Bob Campbell. Like her even more ferocious brother, Yuri, in February 2021, Winter Storm Fern made things tough for the Texas energy industry. But the Texas Oil and Gas and Texas Independent Producers and Royalty Owners Associations say things were getting to business as usual Wednesday, with more cold weather coming this weekend. Quote, "As of Tuesday, operators are beginning to return to normal conditions, with many continuing 24-hour operations through Tuesday, and anticipating a return to normal operations by Wednesday," a TXOGA spokesman said. Continuing the quote, "Volume improvements will continue to increase as higher temperatures improve road accessibility for operators and third-party services. Coordinated response efforts continue to address issues as they rise." The spokesman said the Texas Department of Transportation's road assistance had been extremely helpful. Localized and intermittent power outages occurred in production areas, and operators worked with electric transmission providers to restore power and continue operations, he said. TIPRO President Ed Longenecker said the Texas legislature's post-URI reforms were on target. Quote, "Senate Bill 3 mandated the weatherization of key power plants and natural gas facilities and improved coordination between the electric and gas sectors with stronger emergency planning and backup measures," Longenecker said. Later laws in 2023 and 2025 updated ERCOT governance, strengthened market rules, and enhanced overall system resilience. Quote, "These changes required on-site fuel storage and optimized cold weather maintenance and protections across the natural gas supply chain to limit weather-related interruptions," end quote. He said oil and gas operators effectively responded by insulating pipes, valves, and equipment, adding heat tracing, using methanol injection systems with automatic pumps, preparing steamers for de-icing, building protective shelters, increasing tank storage capacity, performing detailed inspections and testing, training staff on emergency procedures, creating safety-focused contingency plans, positioning crews in advance, adjusting work schedules, tracking forecasts closely, securing backup generators, and identifying priority sites for fast power restoration. Quote, during Winter Storm Fern, Tipro stayed in regular contact with the Railroad Commission of Texas, sharing updates on oil and gas operations to aid coordination and response, Longenecker said. The Railroad Commission played a proactive role in preparing for and managing Fern by issuing a notice to operators on January 20th, ahead of the anticipated severe weather. Quote, this notice alerted oil and gas companies to the incoming cold front, heavy precipitation, and sub-freezing temperatures, urging them to monitor forecasts, implement winterization measures, designate critical facilities for priority power restoration, and promptly report any operational issues to the Railroad Commission's Critical Infrastructure Division, end quote. He said Winter Storm Uri, caused by a severely disrupted polar vortex, delivered record cold across Texas, widespread freezing rain and ice, and multi-day sub-freezing temperatures statewide. Quote, the result was widespread power loss affecting millions, hundreds of deaths, and economic losses over $195 billion, Longenecker said. Winter Storm Fern was not as extreme or long-lasting as Uri, but it still represented the grid's most significant winter challenge in 5 years, end quote. He said Fern produced sub-freezing temperatures, heavy snow and sleet in West Texas, freezing rain and ice in central and northern regions, and extended cold. He said oil field operations during Fern faced difficult conditions, including icy roads, extreme cold, freeze-offs that caused temporary production drops at some companies, and safety-driven slowdowns or shutdowns. Quote, workers in the Permian Basin and Panhandle dealt with hazardous travel, de-iced equipment, and followed protocols that often shortened shifts or halted non-essential tasks, Longenecker said. Oil field crews used layered protective clothing, washed equipment for freeze issues, and worked together to minimize risks on slick surfaces and during restarts, end quote. He said natural gas was central to the state's stronger performance during Fern. Quote, as Texas's leading electricity fuel, natural gas supplies much of the capacity and frequently the largest share of output during winter peaks because it can ramp up quickly and reliably, Longenecker said. This dispatchability allowed the grid to adjust to sudden demand spikes and weather pressures. During Fern, natural gas supply reached generators without major issues, highlighting its importance for grid reliability, energy security, and affordability in extreme conditions, end quote.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.